which is necessary to, for us to finish the derivation of RG equations to first order in epsilon. So we've evaluated this part already. And so what remains is the second cumulant. And so for this, it's necessary to develop this Feynman diagram formalism, because otherwise just the number of terms here is way too large to even write them out on paper. That's interaction phi less phi greater squared, okay. And so I've introduced this graphical notation to represent different contributions to S interactions, right? So we are basically denoting fields either fast or slow by lines. So the slow fields are denoted by solid lines, fast fields are denoted by dashed lines. And so the point represents the, u, the prefactor. So u divided by 4 factorial times 2 pi to the d and delta function, which represents the conservation of momentum. Okay? And so so we can write out the graphical representation for all the 5 distinct terms that enter into S interaction, right? So I have a term with 4 solid lines, so 4 slow fields, plus term with 4 dashed lines, which represents 4 fast fields. Then I have a term with 2 solid lines and 2 dashed lines, plus term with 3 solid lines and 1 dashed line. And then so the other way around, 3 dashed lines and 1 solid line. And as I said, so last time, so we can represent the process of averaging, right? And averaging always means contracting pairs of fast fields, right? As follows from Weak's theorem. I can represent this process by pairing, by connecting dashed lines pairwise, right? So if I want to now evaluate the average of this sum, which we did last time without diagrams, that's for these diagrams aren't necessary. So what I will get? So here there is nothing to average. This term just carries over here without calculation. Now here I can connect all of those dashed lines in a number of ways. So for example, like this, right? But this just gives me a constant, since there are no solid lines left, right? So we can just ignore it. This term, I connect, there is only one way to connect those two dashed lines. And so this is precisely the term which we've evaluated last time, right? So that's, it corresponds to this diagram. And then here, since there is an odd number of dashed lines always, it's not possible to connect them all pairwise, right? And so those terms disappear upon averaging. So basically, after averaging, what we have left is just this one diagram, which we evaluated, okay? Okay, so now you want to actually see how this helps to evaluate this term. Okay, so let me write this term out graphically now. So I want to evaluate 1/2 S squared interaction minus S interaction squared, right? And so graphically, this will have the following form. So here, I'll have to first square S interaction, right? And squaring S interaction graphically just means writing out all possible pairs made of those five terms, right? Yeah.
Sorry, what happens to the first term, the solid x?
Well, nothing happens. It just, you know, it just carries over here. So it doesn't disappear, of course. But so there is nothing to average here. So I didn't write it out. But. So this, graphically, I can represent it in the following way. So I have 1/2, then average, right? And I want to write out all the possible pairs of such vertices, right? So I mean, it means I have this one times this one. Plus this term times this term plus this term times this term and so on. So there are 25 such different terms. Okay, I'm not gonna draw them all out. Yeah.
So just going back a second, one where you connect, like when you have two loops, you say that one goes away?
Sorry?
On the other side where you have two loops, like of the dotted lines?
Yeah, so this, you know, since this does not contain any solid lines, which represent the slow fields, that's just a constant. Okay. It's just some number that we can throw out. Okay, so there are 25 such pairwise terms, right? 5 squared. And then minus, so this thing, which means, so minus 1/2, average of this plus this plus this plus this plus this times the same thing. Okay. So here it means that, you know, here when I start averaging, I have to contract. So I have to connect dash lines pairwise among all those 25 terms. Here I connect them first within those 5 terms and then multiply by the same thing. So I do not connect them, you know, between this bracket and this bracket. Okay? Is this clear? Very important thing to note here, and so this is where diagrams are already helpful. You know, without diagrams, it would be hard to even say what I'm going to say now. So you can notice here that so there are two different types of terms that are going to come from this averaging process. One type of terms would look like this. So I have one piece, right? And then I have another separate piece, and there are no dashed line connections between this piece and this piece, right? And so this bracket only contains such terms, right? Because I make connections here first, and then just multiply by the same thing here, right? I do not make connections between the brackets. So what it means is that such terms, such disconnected, so these are called disconnected diagrams. Right? So if I have any disconnected diagram coming from here, right? this disconnected diagram is going to be canceled by exactly the same disconnected diagram coming from here, right? Because there is a minus sign. So this means that all disconnected diagrams cancel. And all I have to include is only connected diagrams. So this is kind of the meaning of cumulant expansion. Right? So cumulant expansion is an expansion over connected diagrams. And this is true at all orders in the cumulant expansion. Okay? So only connected diagrams contribute. So, you know, for example, what would be an example of a connected diagram? For example, this one, right? I have this term here. I have another term here. So if I contract this line with this line and this line with this line, I get a disconnected diagram, right? But if I instead connect this line, let's say, with this line and this line with this line, I get a connected diagram, right? So it's, if I do this, then this gives me a connected diagram. So such diagrams are present here, but are not present here, and therefore they contribute. Okay? So then what we have to do to find all the possible different terms that are going to contribute here is we have to draw out all the connected diagrams. Okay? And so we don't actually need all of the connected diagrams. So which connected diagrams do we need? We need connected diagrams with either two solid lines, right? So those would correspond to renormalization of R phi squared term, right? So we need diagrams with two solid lines, and that means renormalization of R, right? Or diagrams with four solid lines, and that means renormalization of U phi to the fourth term. Okay, and all the other terms we can throw out, and again, the reasoning will be that that they will be irrelevant, right? For example, diagrams with six solid lines, which are also present, so they would correspond to a phi to the sixth term in this section, and that we will show to be irrelevant. Okay, so let's first find all the connected diagrams with two solid lines, right? Okay, so the first one would be like this. So I have one piece, with one solid line and three dashed lines, and it has to be connected with the same one, right? So after averaging, after connections of all the dashed lines, this becomes it looks like this. Okay, So we can easily write down an expression corresponding to this, which we'll do later. But so the important non-trivial thing is to find the what's called multiplicity factor, meaning how many equivalent terms correspond to this type of diagram. Okay, so let's see how it's calculated. So first of all, there will be a factor of 4 for each of those diagrams corresponding to number of ways I can choose one solid line out of 4, right? So the solid line can be either, you know, if you label the lines 1, 2, 3, 4, the solid line can be either one of those. So therefore, there are 4 distinct terms of this type, right? So I get 4 times 4 for this one. So then there are a number of different ways I can connect those dashed lines, right? I can connect this one with this one, this one with this one, this one with this one, or I can connect this one with this one, this one with this one, and this one with this one. It's all going to be the same. Topologically, it's all the same term, right? And so this number is equal to number of ways I can choose 2 out of 6, right? Number of ways. The way to count this is like this. So suppose I connect any 2 of the lines, right? Then there are 2 different ways I can connect the remaining 2 lines. So therefore, the total number is 6, right? 2 times 3. So 4 times 4 times 6. And let me just explicitly include this factor of 1/2, okay, into the counting. Okay. Times 1/2, and this is equal to 48. Okay. So basically the expression corresponding to this diagram comes with a multiplicity factor of 48 when we write down the actual expression that enters into this second cumulant. Okay. The factors of 4 come from number of ways I can choose 1, which means 1 solid line out of 4. Right. I can connect it here, can connect it here, here, here. Okay. Yeah.
Ones like that in that list of 1/5 that you
use? No. So you remember that when we wrote out those 5 different terms, those also had prefactors because there were a number of equivalent terms I could write in that particular form just by relabeling the way vectors. Okay. So this is one term with 2 solid lines. Another one would look like this. So here I have 1 solid line and 3 dashed. I could also I could also connect, I could also pick, I said that all possible connections here are topologically equivalent. That's not true. So this is one way to connect them where all the lines here at this vertex are connected with lines at the other vertex. Okay. But the other possible type of connection, so I start with the same diagrams here, right? What I could do now is I could connect 1 line here to 1 line here, but then connect the other two lines within each vertex, right? That would also give me a connected diagram. So I have then after averaging, I have a diagram like this. Oops. Okay, so this is also a connected diagram with two solid lines. So what's the multiplicity factor here? So it's still 4 times 4, right? And then, so a number of different ways I can make this connection, right, is 9. Because I can choose, so this line that I'm going to connect here, 3 different ways, right? And then I can choose the other line, which I'm connecting with this one, also 3 different ways. Therefore, the total number of ways is 3 times 3. So this is times 9 times 1/2, and this is equal to 72. Okay? So there are 72 different terms like this. Okay, so another way to make a diagram with two solid lines would be like this. So I take this one on the left, right, two solid lines, two dashed lines, and then I have 4 solid lines on the right. Right, so here, after connection, after contraction, I'm going to have something like this. Right? So what's the multiplicity factor? So there are 6 different terms like this, right? This is a number of ways I can choose 2 out of 4. So this is 6, right? So then here I have to pick which 2 legs out of those 4 I will connect to this left vertex. So it's again number of ways I can choose 2 out of 4. So it's again 6, right? Then, so even if I, when I pick those 2 legs, there are still 2 ways I can connect them to those, right? I can connect them like this, or I can connect them like this. So times 2, right? Then, so I've picked this particular order, this vertex on the left, this vertex on the right, but I can also have, I can also invert it, I can also have this vertex on the left, this vertex on the right. So times 2 again, and times 1/2. So this is equal to, again, 72.
Okay. Where does the second factor of 2 come from?
Second factor of 2 comes from the fact that, you know, so here I've picked this vertex on the left. I drew it on the left, this one on the right, but I can invert it, right? This one on the left, this one on the right. Yeah. You know, this is probably the most non-trivial part of the whole thing, just finding out the correct multiplicity factor. Okay, and so this is it. These are all the possible terms, all the possible connected diagrams, actually, with 2 solid lines. There is nothing else we can draw that's connected and that only has 2 solid lines. Okay. So just those three terms. So now let's do the four solid lines. Okay, so what are the possible possibilities with four solid lines? So one of them will be like this. That's the most straightforward one. So I have two equivalent vertices with two solid lines, right? So after I average, I get this diagram. Okay, so what's the multiplicity factor then? So there are six ways again to choose two out of four. So this is six times six, right? Times two, because there are two ways to connect them, either like this and this, or like this and like this, and times 1/2. So this one is actually pretty simple, and this is equal to 36. Okay. Now, the second possibility would be pairing a vertex with one solid line with another vertex with three solid lines, right? So I have vertex with one solid line and then vertex with three solid lines, okay? So this gives me, after averaging, something like this. right? So, okay, so the multiplicity factor here will be 4. Again, that's the number of ways I can choose one solid line out of 4. Times again 4. One way I can choose number of ways I can choose one dashed line out of 4, right? Times 3, right? Which is the choice of one of those three legs, which I'm going to connect to this one. Times 3, and then times 2 again, which is just flipping the sides. Times 2. Times 1/2, so this is 48. Okay. And so this is it. Those are the only, yeah.
Whenever you have a case where you have two separate diagrams that are identical, shouldn't you have an extra factor of two because there's two ways?
No, because they are identical.
That doesn't show up twice in my theory.
No. Well, it's like, you know, if you have a sum squared, right? You only have one contribution, yeah. That's each term squared. So those are the only connected diagrams that have four legs. Okay? Just those two. Okay, so it's even simpler than that case. So, you know, what are the examples of diagrams which we ignore, which we will ignore here, right? So, well, one possibility would be like this, right? I can have three solid lines and one dashed line connected with another term like this. So this is precisely the diagram that would give me a phi to the sixth term. In the action, right? And so this we will show to be irrelevant. That's why we ignore it. I mean, another possibility would be, let's say, terms with all dashed lines. So those just give me a constant, and so on, right? Anyway, so now we can, we've collected all the contributions that that enter into here with two solid lines and two dashed lines. So let me just collect them all. Erase this.
Good question. So as of right now, we should be able to understand why the 5 to the 6 terms are irrelevant.
They're irrelevant because the dimension is negative. So in the corresponding RG equation, the leading term is going to have a negative coefficient, but we are not quite ready to fully understand that. So we understand that when we analyze the RG equations. Okay. So what I get graphically is the following thing. So S interaction squared minus S interaction squared, average squared. So this is equal to, so I have 48 times this thing. Plus 72 times that. Right? Plus 72 times this. plus 36 times this. And plus 48 of this. Okay. So this is it, right? All we have to do now is evaluate the expressions that correspond to each of those different diagrams. Yeah.
Where do the constant terms go? Not the constant, but where did the all solid line terms go?
Constants we just throw away.
What about the all solid line ones?
All solid lines. Well, there are no all solid lines terms with only four solid lines, right?
Oh, yeah.
In that case, it's going to be
one all solid times the contracted dash.
This cancels.
That's
interesting.
That there. That's
not cancelled.
Which
there is one next to
it. So yeah, if it's disconnected, then it's cancelled. Yeah. Okay. So actually, the terms with two solid lines we are not even going to evaluate, because they contribute only to order epsilon squared, right? And the reason being here that they contain two vertices, right? Each vertex is proportional to U, and as we saw, as I mentioned last time, U at the non-trivial fixed point is going to be proportional to epsilon. So those terms contribute to the equation for R only at second order in epsilon. For this reason, we are going to ignore them. We don't actually need them to order epsilon. So these are order epsilon squared. So we ignore them. So then we have only two terms to deal with. Okay. So let's first look at this ugly one. Okay. So let me try to write out the expression for this term. Actually, you won't even need to write out the expression, as you will see. So the first thing to do when you try to transform this diagram to an expression is to write out explicitly the wave vectors corresponding to each term. And so we have to, when doing that, we have to remember that each point has a delta function, right, which conserves the momenta. So let's say I call this wave vector k1. This I will call q, right, and there is only one momentum corresponding to this line, right? Well, there is only one momentum corresponding to each line, but here, so I have, this line entering here and the same line entering here. I have p here, and let's say those I label k2, k3, and k4, right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
How do you know these terms are order epsilon squared?
Well, because they contain two vertices, and each vertex is proportional to u, right? So to each vertex.
But the rest of the terms have two vertices as well.
Yeah.
Right, but so we need the term proportional to u squared in the equation for u, right? Because we have. So the equation for u looks like this. I have du dl equals epsilon u, right? And then some constant times u squared, right? So this gives me a fixed point value for u that's proportional to epsilon. But the equation for r looks like this. I have dr dl equals 2r plus some other constant times u that we've obtained already at first order, right? So those terms would give me plus c times u squared, right? So therefore, this would give me just a small correction of order epsilon squared to the fixed point value of r.
So you just want a correction for u and not for r, right? In this case, because for me,
No.
Both corrections are u squared.
So we want to obtain, what we want to do is obtain the fixed point, right? So the fixed point values of r and u to first order an epsilon. So this term, c u squared, does not contribute to first order an epsilon. Right? Because, how would I solve this equation? I can solve this iteratively. I first ignore this term because it's smaller compared to this, right? And I get r star is equal to proportional to minus u star, right? Then to get a correction, I would just substitute, that first order value for u into here. And that would give me a correction to r star of second order and epsilon, right? Just think about how you actually solve those equations, right? And you'll see that this term only contributes to r star to second order and epsilon, right? That's all it does. It does not change anything else. It's of course, this all seems easy because we know what we're going to get, right? When we are doing this calculation the first time, these are all very difficult things. And that's why, Wilson got Nobel Prize for this. This is highly non-trivial. with the benefit of hindsight, it's becomes fairly simple. Yes.
You said the AU squared term contributes to order epsilon?
Yeah, because so I'm solving, if I want to solve this equation, right, uh-huh. to find u, right, then I get U proportional to epsilon, right? Okay. So do you want to get a break now?
Yes.
You do? Okay, so 5 minute break then.
Your U equation of order epsilon squared at most, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's, I mean, because, okay, I can understand it. No.
So, the point, I mean, the point is that...
To first order, I have a solution for U here,
for
R in terms of U, right?
Yeah.
So if I make the iterative thing, then adding this term, that's nothing.
Yeah.
That's my equation. The two terms, both the term of u squared here and the term of u squared there, right? But since you know that u is of order epsilon, then for r the correction will be small. Right? But for u, then you have an untrivial correction. Then you can solve in terms of u at 6 point. But u at 6 point is zero. So if you make a correction with r,
it's just really long
that r is a order u, right? First order in epsilon. So if I make another correction with u, then it's a order epsilon squared, which is small. Which is near u equals small. But for the differential equation of u, I need that correction to give me an answer.
I really
U.S. government's open again. Sure.
Yes?
Do they have any money?
No.
We need to, that's why it's open again, because we need to borrow them more money. That's actually the reason why it opened. So we can borrow more money. And then it's good for us again.
Water pressure here is much better. Oh, yeah.
Is there so I was going to read that they should make
that the was still provided.
That's what he meant.
So
it'd
be just about.
Well, yes. I
And the way I think about this, we wrote down the theory at one scale, which was wrong. And so we just have to find the right
intersection of every
I mean, it's the same thing with
mass. We see mech two.
We have vertices here.
No, it's just like we wrote down like this. And we did it somewhere in the PMT yesterday. So we wrote down the
right contribute.
But here we have a new class.
Okay, so let's start again. Yes.
Yeah, the range of infinitives.
So, okay. So here, to actually write out an explicit expression for this diagram, it's convenient to first, explicitly label all the lines with the corresponding wave vectors, right? So I have k1 here, q, p, k2, k3, k4, and what I want, have to remember is that the sum of all the momenta or wave vectors at each point has to be zero, right? Because I have a delta function of the corresponding momenta attached of the sum of corresponding momenta attached to each point. So therefore, so if I look at this vertex here, I must have k1 plus q minus q, and this is because, so this line enters, exits, let's say, the point, and then enters back. So there are two momenta of the same magnitude, but entering with the opposite sign. And then plus p has to be equal to zero, right? So this means that k1 must be equal to minus p, right? But this is impossible because k1 is a slow momentum, which has magnitude from 0 to lambda over b, while p is a fast momentum, which has magnitude from lambda over b to lambda. So they don't overlap. And therefore, this conservation of momentum is impossible. Okay? And so this diagram just gives me 0. Well, because so this K1 corresponds to a solid line, which means slow field, and the corresponding momenta have magnitude from 0 to lambda over b, while this one from lambda over b to lambda. So their equality is impossible. Okay, so then in the end, we only have one diagram to evaluate. Okay? And so you see here how much this this graphical representation for different terms simplifies things, right? Because if you try to just write out all the terms and figure out which one contributes, which one doesn't, we'd be working on this for days. Well, maybe not for days, but for many hours at least. And in any case, I probably would not have patience to get through this. Okay, so let's then write out the term corresponding to this. okay, so I have so let me label the legs again. So I have K1. K2, let's say Q1, Q2, K3, K4. And so let's again take into account conservation of momentum at each vertex. So I must have K1 plus K2 plus Q1 plus Q2 is equal to 0. And also K3 plus K4 minus Q1 minus Q2 is equal to zero. So, you know, this is the only place where drawing arrows may be useful, right? Just figuring out the signs of different wave vectors, but it's simple anyway. Okay, so what do I get? Well, first of all, from here, it follows that K1 plus K2 plus K3 plus K4 is equal to zero. And that's good because this is supposed to be the normalization of U, right? And of U phi to the fourth term, and that's supposed to conserve momentum. So it does conserve it, as it should. So let me solve those equations in the following way. Let me call Q1, let me call this Q, and then Q2, let me find from this equation. So I have Q2 equals K3 plus K4 minus Q, right? And so then this diagram gives me the following expression. So I have U divided by 4 factorial squared, right? Then integral over K1, K2, K3, and K4. And there is a delta function which expresses the fact that K1 plus K2 plus K3 plus K4 is equal to 0. K1 plus K2 plus K3 plus K4. So I have phi less of K1, phi less of K2, phi less of K3, phi less of K4, right? And then, so what this loop gives me, right? A loop made of two dashed lines. So each dashed line corresponds to a propagator of a fast of fast fields, right? So what I have then is integral from lambda over b to lambda d dq 2 pi to the d. So g0 of q, so that corresponds to this bottom line because I called q1 q, times times g0 of, and so Q2 is equal to K3 plus K4 minus Q, or I can also write this as minus K1 minus K2 minus Q, whatever you like. So let's say minus K1 minus K2 minus Q. Okay? So this is it. It's, you know, it's relatively easy here because so for example in when you have diagrams for fermions, you also have to take into account the signs that you know that come from the anti-commutation for fermions, and that makes things more difficult. Okay? Here, everything is relatively straightforward. Okay, so let me call this integral I2, right? So I had I1 before, so let me call this I2. So this is integral from lambda over b to lambda g dq 2 pi to the g, g0 of q, g0 of minus k1 minus k2 minus q. Now, so Q here is a fast momentum, right? With a large magnitude from lambda would be to lambda, while K1 and K2 are slow momenta, okay? And so let me do the following then. Let me just neglect this K1 and K2, okay? So again, the reasoning is irrelevance of this dependence, and I will show later explicitly that it's irrelevant. But so what this would dependence on K1 and K2 correspond to, right? This would correspond to the following thing. So initially, I had my constant U to be just a constant, right? This dependence means that after one step of RG, after evaluating integral over the fast fields, this U acquires actually dependence on momenta of the slow fields which are attached to this U, right? And so what I will show is that this dependence is irrelevant, okay? So in particular, what I can do is expand this in Taylor series with respect to K1 and K2, right? Something like U0 plus, well, so I think the first term that would be allowed by symmetry would correspond to, anyway, well, let me just do it later. I don't get confused now. So anyway, what I will show is that this explicit dependence of U on K1 and K2 will turn out to be relevant in the same way as, let's say, 5 to the 6 term, okay? So this type of terms will have dimension which is negative, okay? Okay, so then this thing becomes even simpler. Integral of lambda from lambda over b to lambda, dq to pi to the g. And then, so since the propagator only depends on the magnitude of the wave vector, right? So the propagator is 1 over r plus q squared, then this becomes just g0 squared of q. Okay? So remember that when we calculated correction at first order in U, the integral we had to evaluate was g0 of Q. Now it's just g0 squared. Okay, so this is integral from lambda over b to lambda dq to pi to the d 1 over r plus q squared, okay? And it's evaluated in exactly the same way as this integral, which we did before. So what we do is expand this function in Taylor series with respect to r divided by q squared, right? Yeah.
No, from the term of.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I should just erase it. Yeah, it's confusing. Okay. Am I going too fast? You don't have time to write or. Anyway, so you know, evaluation of this integral is exactly the same as before, so I'm not going to do it explicitly. I'll just write down the answer, okay? And the answer is that this is equal to this factor of S sub d to pi to the d, where S is the surface area of unit sphere in d dimensions, and then lambda to the d delta l r plus lambda squared, where I've again assumed that I can write factor b here as e to delta l, and delta l is small. Okay. Okay, and this result, okay, so now I can collect everything, collect all the contributions to S prime of file S. Okay, so I have S prime of file S equals so 1/2 integral over k squared plus r plus u over 2i1 times modulus of file S of k squared. So this part we derived yesterday, right? That's a contribution from the first cumulant. And then I have plus, so u divided by 4 factorial, right? And then this correction, so it's going to be u squared divided by 4 factorial squared times 36, right? Because that's the 36 is a multiplicity factor of this diagram. So I get minus 36 u divided by 4 factorial squared times i2, right? And a minus sign just comes from so it's that minus. The second cumulant enters with a minus sign. And then I have integral k1, k2, k3, k4, phi less of k1, phi less of k2, phi less of k3, phi less of k4, and the delta function. 2 pi to the d delta k1. Plus k2 plus k3 plus k4. Okay, so now the last step again is rescaling momenta to bring the cutoff to lambda from lambda over b. So k prime goes to b times k prime, and k goes to b times k prime. K prime is equal to b times k. And then phi prime equals b minus d plus 2 over 2 phi less. Okay. And so let me skip the remaining details of how you get the recursion relations, right? So from this, we get the RG recursion relations. So R prime equals R plus U over 2 I1 B squared. So this, again, this one we derived last time. Yesterday, and then u prime is going to be equal to u minus 3/2. So that's 36 divided by 4 factorial, right? 3/2 times i2 and b to 4 minus d. And u squared, of course. Okay. And then, if I rewrite those now in differential form, I get the RG equations. Right? So dr, dl is 2r plus u over 2 sd 2 pi to the d. lambda over d r plus lambda squared, and then du dl is epsilon u minus 3/2 u squared s d 2 pi to the d lambda over d r plus lambda squared squared. Okay.
You're rescaling here by assuming that the anomalous dimension is zero.
Yeah, so anomalous dimension turns out to be zero at first order in epsilon. Actually, we saw it last time already.
If I had the correction, for example, for the R term,
right,
then the anomalous dimension would still be zero?
At this order, it's still zero, yeah. At order epsilon, it's still zero. So at order epsilon square, there would be a correction to anomalous dimension. Yeah.
How do you tell if there's an anomalous dimension or not?
Sorry?
Like, what was the strategy for telling whether there is an anomalous
dimension? Well, so anomalous dimension comes from here, right? So I want to make the coefficient of this term equal to 1/2. So if I can do that without having an anomalous dimension here, then that's fine. And so to order epsilon, I can do it. Okay, so now what we want to do is analyze those equations. And so as I will show already next time, so basically we will be able to find critical exponents from the behavior of those equations near fixed points. Okay, basically from the stability analysis of the solutions of those equations near fixed points. Yeah.
So we said before that when I'm on a fixed point of the normalization transformation, then I'm either at the critical point or really far away from the critical point.
Right.
How can I distinguish that? It depends whether I began with a critical temperature or not.
Well, I mean, so as we will see again, the way, so there will be two types of fixed points. Either fixed points with R that's close to zero, either zero or close to zero, so that's a critical point, right? And then R flowing to either plus infinity or minus infinity, and that's, you know, that corresponds to very high temperature or very low temperature, or zero temperature. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, once we draw out the structure of the flows, right, which correspond to solutions of those equations, then it will be clear. Okay, so let's first find the fixed points here explicitly, right? So okay, so if I set the right-hand side of the equation for u to zero, then I get, either u star equals zero, and then from the first equation, r star is also equal to zero, and that's the Gaussian fixed point, which I've already mentioned. So this is Gaussian fixed point, right? And then, so if u is not equal to zero, then u is proportional, u star is proportional to epsilon, and in particular, so explicitly, this is equal to, 16 pi squared epsilon divided by 3, where I have set this dimension here to 4, right? So since we are expanding in small deviations from 4 dimensions, right? Here, since u squared is already proportional to epsilon, I just have to take d here equals to 4. Okay? So I will I'll have the surface area of unit sphere in four dimensions here, and then lambda to the 4. So that's where this thing comes from. So it turns out to be the value of u at the fixed point is independent of the cutoff, in fact. It only depends on the epsilon. And then r star, so the value of r actually does depend on the cutoff. And this is equal to minus epsilon divided by 6 times lambda squared. Okay.
Sorry, can you repeat what you got rid of the cutoff by taking d equals 4?
Sorry?
You got rid for the of the cutoff for u.
No, no, I did not. I did not get rid of it. I just so if I solve this equation to first order an epsilon, right? So r is already proportional to epsilon, so I can just set it to 0. Then lambda to the 4th cancels with this lambda to the 4th. So I'm solving again. I'm solving, of course, to first order an epsilon. Yeah. Because in principle, you know, this is a highly nonlinear equation, right? It contains r here in the denominator, but I'm solving only to first order an epsilon. Okay. So, okay, so first of all, what is the meaning? So let's assume that we are below 4 dimensions. So epsilon is greater than 0, right? So, well, so first of all, u star is positive, which is a good thing, right? So u should be, u must be positive if you are cutting off the expansion to only fourth order in phi, right? Otherwise, we get nonsense, since the minimum of action is going to be at infinity, right? At phi equals infinity. So now, r star, the value of r star is negative, right? So what is the meaning of that? Well, so we will see that basically these values of r and u will correspond to the critical point. And so the fact that this is negative, right, expresses the fact that, so in mean field theory, r corresponding to the critical point is 0, right? That's when t equals tc. What this is saying is that when we take into account fluctuations around mean field theory, the critical point moves to the left, to lower temperatures. As we should expect, because so fluctuations make ordering more difficult, and therefore the temperature at which ordering occurs becomes lower. Okay, so that's the meaning of this being negative. Okay. Okay. So now let's do the following. So let's linearize these equations near both fixed points, okay, near the Gaussian fixed point and near the second field fixed point, which is called Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So this is Wilson-Fischer fixed point. Okay. So let me first. So let's first look at the Gaussian fixed point. This is simpler, right? So let me define delta r and delta u, which will be deviations of r and u from their fixed point values. Well, in the case of Gaussian fixed point, these are just r and u. But in general, I'll define delta r and delta u. And I want to linearize those equations in the deviations of r and u from the fixed point, right? Linearizing delta r and delta u. And let me also, just for brevity, introduce the following notation. Let me call this whole thing, which enters into both equations. Let me call this k sub d. Okay. So then, so from the first equation, I get d delta r dl equals 2 delta r, right, plus delta u over 2 k sub d lambda minus 2, right? So, well, I have to neglect this r, right, because this would be already of second order in, so if I expand with respect to r here, right, this will give me corrections of second order in, you know, u times r. Yeah.
We're assuming that epsilon is greater than zero, right? So we're approaching to the equal 4 from the left.
Well, not necessarily from the left. We can approach from the right as well, but epsilon is small.
Yeah, but then if I approach from the right, then the argument you used before changes.
Yeah, yeah. So this Wilson-Fischer fixed point is only physical below four dimensions. Above four dimensions, it's the Gaussian one that's physical. Yeah. So and then this equation, I just have to ignore this term completely, right? Because u squared is small. So, I mean, for the Gaussian fixed point, r, delta r is the same as r, and delta u is the same as u, right? So I get d delta u dl is just equal to epsilon delta u, right? And so if I write this in matrix form, I get, d dl delta r delta u equals the following matrix, 2, then 1 half k sub d inverse lambda squared, then 0 and epsilon multiplying delta r and delta u. So let me call this matrix M. Okay, and so as you know, the behavior of solutions of this linearized equation depends on the eigenvalues of this matrix, right? So to solve this equation, we have to find the eigenvalues. So let me go over this thing. So since I have 0 here, eigenvalues are clearly just the diagonal elements of this matrix, right? 2 and epsilon. So let me call them like this. I have lambda sub t. You will understand this notation in a second. Lambda sub t, that's the first eigenvalue, is going to be equal to 2, right? And then the second eigenvalue I will call lambda sub u tilde, okay? And this is equal to epsilon. So now let's find the eigenvectors that correspond to those eigenvalues, right? So the first eigenvector so I have to solve basically this equation, right? M minus the corresponding eigenvalue times the unit matrix times the eigenvector is equal to zero, right? So for this eigenvalue, what do I have? I have 1/2 k sub d lambda inverse squared times the second component of the eigenvector v sub t has to be equal to zero, right? So I'm just multiplying this matrix, right, minus lambda t times the unit matrix by vector v sub t. So this means v sub t 2, second component is equal to 0, right? And the first component must be 1 if you want to normalize this vector, right? The first component is not restricted by this equation. So therefore, the eigenvector corresponding to this eigenvalue, v sub t, is equal to 1, 0, okay? So it means that the direction v sub t is the same as the direction of r, right? And that's why I call it v sub t, because r is the same as t, the reduced temperature, okay? Okay, so now let's find the second eigenvector. So the second eigenvector will turn out to be less trivial. So if I do the same thing for this eigenvector, I get 2 minus epsilon v u tilde 1, right? And then plus 1/2 k sub d lambda inverse squared v u tilde 2 has to be equal to 0, right? So this means that both components are non-zero, right? So if I solve this equation combined with normalization condition, then I get, actually I won't, sorry, I won't normalize it. I'll just keep the, I'll just set v u tilde 2 equal to 1, right, and then find vu tilde 1. I don't really need normalized eigenvectors. It's not important. So then from here, from this equation, vu tilde 1 is equal to leading order in epsilon, which in this case means epsilon equals 0, is equal to minus lambda squared divided by 32 pi squared. And that, again, setting the dimension here to 4. Okay. So the second eigenvector, which corresponds to this eigenvalue, is u tilde is equal to minus lambda squared 32 pi squared and 1. Okay, and so this eigenvector, you know, it combines non-trivially both u and t directions, and that's why I called it u tilde and not u. Yeah. There is an epsilon correction, but I ignore it, right? Because I want to find this eigenvector to leading order, right? If I had a zero here, then I would include epsilon. But I mean, epsilon would just give me a small correction, so it's just not important. It was, you know, I have a direction in my RU space, and correction of order epsilon just rotates the vector slightly. That doesn't matter. Okay? Okay, and so then if I rewrite this equation in terms of those eigenvalues, right? So I can say that you know, the vector delta r delta u is equal to, let's say, some t times v sub t plus u tilde times v u tilde, right? Then the equations for t and u tilde are just, so dt dl equals 2t, and d u tilde dl is equal to epsilon u tilde, right? And the solutions are clearly t of l is equal to some initial t, which we are starting from, and then e to 2l, right? And then u tilde of l is u tilde of 0 e to epsilon l, right? So this means the following, right? So if I now draw the these solutions in the RU plane, they look like this. So I have U and R, right? And let me first assume that, just one more minute, let me assume first that the dimension is greater than 4, right? So epsilon is negative, right? Okay, so the t direction is the same as, and so the fixed point, the Gaussian fixed point is right here at the origin, right? U is equal to 0, r is equal to 0. So the t direction is the same as r, right? And you see that from here that if I deviate slightly from the fixed point, right? If I deviate slightly from t equals 0, this is going to grow exponentially under RG, right? So this means that in the R direction, this fixed point is unstable, right? I always flow away from this fixed point. Now, if I take u tilde direction, so this is some direction like this, right? When epsilon is negative, right, this direction is stable, meaning that since the exponential here is negative, right, epsilon is negative, if I deviate from the fixed point slightly in the u tilde direction, I always flow back to u tilde, okay? So this kind of fixed point is called stable, right? Because stable fixed point means that it's unstable only in one direction. So direction t or r is always unstable, right? Because the t controls where we are in the phase diagram. T is just the temperature. So if you change temperature, you always deviate from the critical point, right? So this direction is always going to be unstable. But then the question is whether the second direction is stable or not, okay? And so in dimensions greater than 4, the Gaussian fixed point turns out to be a stable fixed point, okay? Okay, so we'll discuss the meaning of this tomorrow, okay?